If you're trying to figure out the difference between eccentric and concentric orientation, or yielding and overcoming, this will be a good video for you. Good morning, happy Monday. I have Neural Coffee in hand and it is perfect. All right, coming off a solid weekend. Had my first combatives, very exciting about that. I survived it, didn't get beat up too bad. So it was kind of fun. Looking forward to a big week this week. Today's Q&A is with Ryan. So I got a chance to talk to Ryan. I've known Ryan for a while. Ryan's a great coach down in Kentucky. So if you're ever near Peak Fitness and Sports Training, I suggest you stop by and see him. It'll be worth your efforts. Ryan is kind of a superhuman when it comes to picking up heavy things. He's incredibly strong. He only weighs about 200 pounds, but I think he's got a triple bodyweight deadlift or something like that. So maybe even more than that. The Q&A covers a lot of review concepts that I think are still somewhat confusing for people, and I understand that. So we talk about eccentric, concentric orientations, yielding and overcoming actions, and we start to put them into some context. So we talk about cutting, a little bit of powerlifting, and some individualization of training. So again, I think this is a really, really good review call for a lot of people. To help clarify some of these concepts. So if you have any questions or you'd like to participate in a 15-minute consult, go to askbillhartman@gmail.com, askbillhartman@gmail.com, and I will see you guys tomorrow.
We are rolling. Clock has started. All Fire right. your question, young man.
All right. I want to kind of dive into some more of the nuance with the eccentric, concentric orientation versus the yielding and overcoming. And so I think the biggest thing is, you know, to what extent is it useful to prioritize a yielding strategy over gaining some eccentric orientation?
Okay.
I know, like, you know, with an athlete, it can be very dependent on what the needs of the sport are. But, you know, to my way of thinking and the conversations we've had, the only way I'm going to get eccentric orientation is more or less to stop training. So I want to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly.
Okay. So let's distinguish between the two first and foremost, because it's very distinct. Okay. Muscle behavior is determined by eccentric versus concentric orientation. So we're looking at a moment in time and we're looking at a relative length of the muscle tissue itself. So this is the part that actually contracts based on the nervous system input. Mm-hmm. This is what determines range of motion. Yielding and overcoming is connective tissue behavior. This is a viscoelastic tissue that behaves very specifically based especially on the rate of loading. So the faster that I load a viscoelastic tissue, the more resistance it provides, the stiffer it behaves. The slower I load it, okay, and again, we're talking relative speeds here, because some things look really, really fast, but from a relative standpoint, the tissues are being actually loaded at a slower rate. So if I were to make a comparison, if I jump off of a box, so I jump off, let's just say I jump off of a 20-inch box, mm-hmm. and I land, that is actually a slower rate of loading compared to a max effort back squat, because the max effort back squat load is instantaneous. It is already there. Whereas as I'm coming down from the box, I have an anticipatory concentric orientation of musculature. And then as I make my initial contact, like where I barely touch my toe. So again, we have to look at this thing in really slow motion. You look at the duration of the exposure to get to the point where the maximum load is applied based on the force production. There's a lot of time in there compared to an instantaneous load with a heavy weight. Right. So that distinguishes the two elements of behavior. Like I said, a lot of people get confused because we talk about a yielding action when we're going into and out of a cut, which looks really, really fast. And it is, visually speaking, it is very, very quick. But as far as the rate of loading on the tissues, there is a time span where I'm moving into, where I make ground contact, so that the tissue has to expand or elongate. It stores energy under those circumstances. And then as I change direction and I reorient, now the tissue can actually release that energy and it behaves more stiffly as I come out of the cup. Okay. Does that help you distinguish between the two?
Yes.
Okay. Now, so if you have a situation where you have a great deal of concentric orientation, that's where you're going to see the greatest movement and limitations. So goal number one then is to create greater eccentric orientation to allow more motion to occur if that's the goal.
Can we play off of this cutting example?
Absolutely. So
if I've got somebody who's just very toned up, lots of training, they're going to go into this cut and they're going to maintain concentric orientation in most cases, which is what we want, because then they can use the rebound of the connective tissues.
Correct. If they can access that.
Yes. What if there is not, they're so concentric that their ability to load the cuts is ineffective.
Okay. So look at it at the two ends. So if I am, let's just say I'm concentric overcoming.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that is a muscle that is prepared, that is producing high force, right? And the connective tissues are stiff. So as I go into the cut, I don't yield as much. So the amount of energy storage that I use is somewhat limited, but my ability to come out of the cut is not. But the problem is that I never got the initial storage in the first place. So that's going to kind of slow me down coming out of the cut. Now let's take an opposing example where if somebody that doesn't create the stiffness as well. So they go into the cut, they absorb this massive amount of energy, and they're slow coming out of the cut because they can't turn it around and release that energy, right? So, mm-hmm. So there's a difference. And some of this is going to be genetically determined. This is why some people are faster than other people, is because their connective tissues are just better designed to do these really, really cool things. But we can train this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Just based on the way that your loading strategies in the gym. If I'm a power lifter, you think about, I want the minimum amount of eccentric orientation that I need, and I need just enough yielding action to store and release energy as I make the turnarounds in my lifts. Okay. Because if you have too much, then there's a lot of distance that can be created with expansion or a dissipation of my force production, which is what I don't want. I want it to be focused so I can create the lift.
Okay.
So
if I'm loading just any exercise, am I going to be yielding, or is it possible to get some eccentric orientation? Because there's going to be muscular activity trying to allow the minimum amount of tissue length, correct?
Well, depending on what the goal is. So again, it's like, if I'm a power lifter, how important is my deep squat?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just not that important to me. I need enough, because if I'm competitive, I want to get white lights. Correct. I want a good lift. So I need enough to access that. Now, the yielding action does help me, because especially with the turnaround, but think about this. It's like, if I yield too much, I dissipate some of that force that I use to actually lift the weight. And again, this is why some people are better power lifters than others. One of the reasons why you have superhuman strength for a guy that weighs 200 pounds is because you yield really, really well in your skeleton, but most likely the connective tissues that are directly attached to your musculature is very, very stiff, right? And this is what you'll see with people that are very, very powerful, very, very explosive, and very, very strong, right? The stiffer the tissue, right? If I can get it to yield, it releases more energy, right? Just go into the gym and just check your rubber bands. If you take the skinniest rubber band that you have and the fattest rubber band that you have, and now it's easier to stretch the skinnier rubber band, But if I could stretch the fat rubber band the same distance, which one releases more energy?
The fat one.
Absolutely. So you see what I'm saying? It's like, you know, it's some people need 400 pounds on their back to create the yielding action.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see this, and you'll see an improvement in someone's squat. You know, visually, the representation of their technique will improve under the heavier loads because it is actually helping them to create the yielding action that they need.
So I want to take it to somebody who's got a little bit different needs than a powerlifter, say like a pitcher. They're trying to produce a ton of propulsion in a very short time, but they need the time to yield, correct?
Correct.
What if they've got so much, just let's just call it extensor tone, that's shoving them forward, they're late on late, concentric all over, and I pull them back with some yielding strategies, do they need to recapture some level of eccentric orientation as well?
Maybe. I mean, we always have to look at these people as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a problem because everybody says, okay, you're a right-handed pitcher. You need to be on the right-handed pitcher program, right? Mm-hmm. So they treat all pitchers the same, which is not true, unfortunately.
Right.
Because if I take a pitcher that's 5'10", 225 pounds, and I have a pitcher that is 6'5", 215 pounds, I got news for you. They produce the velocity in different ways. One needs a little bit more time. One doesn't turn as well. And the other one needs to be able to compress very, very quickly, mm-hmm. right? But he has more time. So again, we can't treat them the same way. We have to say, oh, you do it this way and you do it this way. And then we try to provide them the access to their potential. And that's why this is hard though. So yeah. it's like you and I are having this conversation and you go, oh, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
And then you go and you look at a real human and you go, uh-oh, now what do I do, right?
Yeah.
But the principles don't change. It's just a matter of getting to know someone. So somebody walks in the door, it's like, I don't know exactly what to do with them. I get an idea and then we do something and then we see what happens. And then based on that, we do the next thing. People think that they can predict what's going to happen. And I would respectfully disagree. It's like, I think we need to actually train these people over time. And that's how we figure this stuff out.
Yeah. So I think one of the mistakes, or at least the lens I was looking at in the past, I thought I was, you know, recapturing some range of motion that was maybe eccentric orientation when I was doing unilateral work, but I was just getting better at yielding.
Quite possibly. So again, it's like what you need to look at is you have to have some form of key performance indicator that you're going to measure against. You do your intervention. And then you remeasure and you say, okay, what happened under those circumstances? This is how training should be because it's incredibly complex. There are things that are going on in training that we have no idea about. Mm-hmm. I am convinced of this. We have no idea. We don't even know what's taking place. But we have observations that we can use to say, okay, that was a good thing, or that wasn't such a good thing. And then what we want to do over time is do a whole lot more good things and a whole lot less of the stuff that doesn't either seem to matter or creates a negative consequence, right? Everybody thinks that there's like a cookbook. You go, oh, okay, you do this, you do this, you do this, and then good things happen. It's like, no. Like you could do that, you know, again, you put everybody on the right-handed pitcher program. That's a right-handed pitcher. It's like, okay, three or four guys are going to do really well. Three or four guys are not going to do well at all. And then everybody kind of falls in the middle, you know, and we accept favorable change for the best favorable change. And I respectfully disagree about that too. So I don't know if I created more confusion for you.
Maybe. I got one tag along question. I think you can answer.
Go ahead.
Super compressed pitcher needs to yield, or a young athlete who's maybe just doesn't manage gravity well, but they also need to add muscle mass and add size to produce for better force production because they're still underpowered.
Okay. How are you measuring underpowered relative to what?
You know, in the case of a pitcher, I'd say maybe their arm strength is low or
Again, how are you measuring? Like, what's the comparison to determine that one, they have the potential for it, and number two, again, how do you know? I mean, versus, I mean, I understand that you can measure pitching velocity and things like that,
right.
And there's any number of parameters. But again, it's like, what are you using to determine this? Like what
is? So I would say maybe relative to peers. You know.
Okay, but again, you can't compare them to anyone but themselves. So there, I think lies a little bit of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because genetically speaking, we just don't know.
Right.
And so again, I would encourage you to look at this from a process oriented standpoint. It's like, okay, if you think that he needs greater force production, if you think more muscle mass is the answer, do that. And then see what happens. I'm totally okay with that. Right. But you better have some form of indicator to follow that's going to let you know very, very quickly. Sorry, if we're on the wrong path, we need to make a change very, very quickly.
Right? Perfect.
I think again, the experience of working with people over time is one of those elements that is lacking, because again, people are looking for yes and no answers, black and white solutions, when the reality is, it's like, we are so gray, it's not funny. It's like, if you say, okay, this kid is underpowered, we need to add force production, go ahead and add force production. But like I said, have something that you're measuring against, so you know that if I accidentally take something away that was important, you know, if you take range of motion away from somebody that needs, you know, as much range of motion as a pitcher does, right? Did you help? You know, and there's probably times where, you know, adding force production, especially through their levels of, there's differing levels of maturity, mm-hmm. where it's going to be like, absolutely, we got to drive tons of force production. I want to drive his ability to lift heavy things through the roof, because I know it's going to contribute to performance. But that's not everybody. You can't put everybody on that same program, because they're all at different places.
Okay. That was great.
Good. Yeah. I hope it's helpful. If you have questions, just send me an email. You know how to get a hold of me.
Will do.
Yeah. Or post them up in the Facebook group.
Okay. Sounds right? Good. I'll do that.
All right, brother. Have a great day. Good to see you.
All right. Bye.
Ultimately, that's what I want you to think about as you're learning and understanding these tests. It's like, yeah, it's really cool to throw somebody on the table and show the movement limitation, do something, and then make that movement limitation disappear, so to speak. Right. But ultimately, what I want you to be able to do is go into the gym, just have people move, perform their exercise activities, and then be able to coach and cue them with that understanding.
Good morning. Happy Tuesday. I have NeuroCoffee in hand, and it is perfect. All right. Busy Tuesday, clinic day as usual. So we're going to dive right into today's Q&A. This is a conversation that I had with Andrew, and Andrew's in a really cool place in his evolution as a coach. So he is working on becoming more reliable with his table tests and his interpretation. So we're actually going to talk through some of that. We're going to use a little bit more of a shoulder frame of reference in this one, but we also talk about some of the confirmations that we use as checks and balances in the hip. And so we're going to talk a little bit about iterations and such that are very important when you're learning how to interpret these things. Ultimately, what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to eliminate the table tests from necessity and hopefully train the eye to be a little bit more effective using table tests only when we need to, as confirmations, or when we do get stuck, and we do get stuck, because this is very complex, it is very gray, and as I like to say, the measurements tend to be a little dirty anyway. So, Andrew, thank you for your participation and your question. I will see you on the Coffee and Coaches Conference call, as we always do every Thursday morning at 6 a.m. So everybody have a terrific Tuesday, and we will see you tomorrow.
And the clock has started. What is your question, Andrew?
So in the past year, I have started to use your sort of test retest method, and I've really incorporated table tests into all of the work that I do with clients as a way to see where their body's at, so to speak. And it's really, really good. It's been perfect for all of my interactions with clients and my work with clients. It's been very illuminating in terms of, you know, directions that I need to take to help them. And I realized recently that I don't understand the utility of certain table tests that you mentioned in uh-huh. your videos. Yep. And not that I understand the ones that I do all that well in the first place, but I have some idea.
Okay.
So specifically, the ones that I'm wondering about, just to kind of narrow the focus, are shoulder and hip, if we have time for it, adduction and abduction. And okay. I am unsure of how or if there is a difference in what, let's say, a shoulder abduction test would tell us about dorsal rostral expansion, right? Yep. Versus what an overhead flexion test would tell us about okay. dorsal rostral expansion in that 90 plus range.
Okay. So let's use the shoulder example first. Okay. All right. So if we look at the way that the lungs fill, if you're taking your breath in because of gravity, it's kind of like filling up a glass of water. So the lung would fill from the bottom up. Okay. And as we're going to assume like upright stance under these circumstances. Okay. And so as the lungs fill, there's certain space that you would be able to take up. So I would have to have certain expansion capabilities to fill that lung up. And based on the way that it fills, it actually provides us a physical shape that allows us to access movement. Okay. So that's what we're doing. When we're measuring people on the table, what we're doing is we're using these movements to identify where you can expand and where you compress. If you compress, there is typically going to be a limitation in a specific range of motion. So when we're talking about horizontal abduction in the shoulder compared to flexion, there's going to be different spaces in the posterior rib cage where we're going to be able to expand to be able to access those movements. Because what I have to be able to do is change the physical shape of the rib cage, the position of the shoulder blade relative to the upper arm bone, relative to the humerus, to be able to access some motion. So when we're talking about something where we would use like a horizontal abduction test in the shoulder, that's going to be representative of part of the dorsal rostral area. So the dorsal rostral area means the upper back, real simple, okay? But we're going to talk about a very specific area, which is probably going to be somewhere in the general vicinity of sort of the middle of the shoulder blade to the bottom of the shoulder blade. And again, we're talking about gradients of fill here. So it's not going to be an exact thing, but again, we can use it sort of as a target. So when we talk about dorsal rostral expansion, this is what we're talking about under most circumstances. So that horizontal abduction measure is going to tell me that you can or cannot fill up that space.
Okay.
If we're going to go overhead farther, that means I need more fill higher up into the rib cage. So now we're going to talk about that space that's above what I just talked about. So now we're talking about sort of that middle of the shoulder blade all the way up to the top of the shoulder blade, which is going to be roughly, it's going to be somewhere between, you know, from T2 is the top of the shoulder blade to the middle is about that T5 area. So we're going to talk about filling up that space. And for me to access an overhead reach in external rotation, so we got to be really specific about this because we're looking at external rotation measures. Our shoulder flexion is going to provide us a measure of external rotation. Our horizontal abduction are going to provide us a measure of external rotation. So to be able to access both of those positions to whatever would be their full excursion, I would need expansion in both of those areas. So now if I measure somebody and I see this limitation, what this measure is now telling me is, you're not expanding in this one specific area. So guess what? If I know where you can't expand, I know what activities to start to select for you. Because if I can help you create the expansion in those areas, I have now recaptured the ability to access movement that you didn't have before. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. So if you measured somebody And you did an overhead flexion test with the external rotation.
Yep.
That shoulder blade would be wrapped around away from the spine just a little bit, right? So it's going to be a little bit this way, and then it has to, it kind of does this upward rotation. And so the abduction test would be measuring a little bit more in the center, right? So right, because the shoulder blade is wrapping around this way towards my center. Okay. So
hang on, boss. Okay. So to, if we're talking about flexion, am I correct? We're talking about the to reach the end range shoulder flexion. Okay. So to do that, the scapula has to move into a position of inhalation in that posterior aspect of the rib cage. You would already have upwardly rotated the scapula in that position. So we're past that point. So what's going to happen now, as that area expands, it's going to move the medial border of the scapula posteriorly and away from the spine. So you had the part away from the spine, correct? Because I have to make a space there, right? So it's going to my definition of external rotation, so it's not the definition that would be traditional, because I talk about inhalation versus exhalation positions as ER and IR. But what we're going to do is we're going to create a space in that area. So you describe the space correctly. What's going to be included in that is you're going to have that area of the spine from that middle area of the scapula upward, you're going to have the spine turning in that direction as well. Because if the spine doesn't turn in that direction, there's no way that you're going to finish that shoulder flexion measure. I have to have space. That posterior space has to expand, which means the scapula is going to actually tilt back and again, re-inhale, if you will, in that position. Does that make sense?
Got it. So I'm wondering,
like by traditional standards, it would be like this posterior tilt and then a little bit of I think it would be considered internal rotation, which is not correct. It's actually external rotation, because it would be described this as similarly as it would be in the pelvis. The way that the ilium moves in the pelvis and the way the scapula move are the same. And so that we should call them the same thing. And that's basically what I do.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess I'm wondering, because I can't even think of a circumstance because I haven't done the abduction test. I'm wondering what would be a circumstance where either the abduction test would confirm like a suspicion from the overhead test or vice versa, because I can't even put myself in that head frame right now.
Well, so they're both measuring aspects of external rotation, which is valuable because now I have confirmations of what my capabilities may be. And so let's just say that I have one external rotation test that measures in the so-called normal range, which is actually just an average. And then I have two tests that are limited, then chances of that one test that was actually supposedly normal, it's not going to be normal. So because I need all of the posterior expansion on the backside to have full external rotation capabilities. So I have three measures that I can confirm myself against. So now I can tell when someone is oriented in a certain position. So let's just say that I have somebody that has a thorax that is anteriorly oriented, but when I lay them down on the table, they tilt backwards. And so what that does is it would potentially magnify a traditional external rotation measure, and it can potentially magnify shoulder flexion. Okay. So now I have I have three tests. I have my abduction test, my external rotation test by traditional measures, and shoulder flexion that will all help me confirm whether I have that posterior expansion capability available to me. And if not, like I said, it tells me where to target, but it can also provide me information as to whether I have somebody that has actually fallen backwards on the table, because what that does is it actually turns the shoulder in such a way that, like I said, it would magnify a couple of my shoulder measures. So again, that's why these become valuable. That's why a battery of tests becomes valuable, because now I have confirmations. Okay. Now, here's the cool thing. Let's go back down to the pelvis for a second. So you talked about hip, okay? So the hip is behaving the same way the shoulder does. So flexion, abduction, and external rotation measures are exactly the same in the pelvis as they are in the shoulder. So it's going to tell me whether I have that posterior aspect of the pelvis capable of expanding under the same circumstances. The cool thing about that, though, is that usually under most circumstances, unless I have a constraint change of some sort, like literally a structural problem, that upper thorax and that pelvis are going to behave the same way. And so when I have limitations in external rotation in the hip, I'm going to have limitations in external rotation in the shoulder. So now I got double confirmation. So I can actually use my pelvis measures and my shoulder measures against each other to confirm my suspicions as to whether, number one, am I measuring correctly? And if I am measuring correctly, which takes time, so you have to be reliable with yourself. Okay. That's what's important. So you got to take bunches and bunches of measures to get really, really good at it. So you can measure consistently. It's not about being able to measure exactly like someone else. It's you being reliable with yourself. But once I can do that, then I can start to use these measures if need be. Now, let me say this. Okay. You don't always have to use your table test. In fact, if you're working with somebody in the gym, I would say that you might never need to use them once you understand what these tests represent. Okay. So if I know that certain tests are associated with expansion or compression in certain areas, I also know how you move through space during an exercise. So if I'm watching somebody doing like some sort of cable chop activity or cable lift or a press or a push or a pull or whatever it might be, and I see something that seems a little off as far as that activity goes, I know what area of motion you're trying to access. So again, if I was looking at, say you're watching somebody press overhead for whatever reason, and you see it that like they have to do this big lean to the side, they can't maintain a certain measure of shoulder position, I can actually use my understanding of tests to help me identify what the movement limitation may be that is causing this compensatory strategy that's being demonstrated. So again, this becomes very, very powerful because again, I don't want to have to do the table test. If I can identify these things, if I can just take you through normal activities, I can watch you squat in the gym. I can watch you do split squats. I can watch you do toe touches. I can watch you do presses. I can watch you do pulls. And from watching you do those things and understanding how the movement relates to these areas of compression and expansion, I can now identify if there's a movement restriction or if you're using a compensatory strategy that maybe I don't want you to use, because some of them are very useful. Okay. But again, that's the decision that I have to make. Again, the table tests are not a necessity. They are to teach you to understand how we access these positions and movements. Once you understand them, you may not need them at all. Maybe there are confirmations at some point in time because we all get confused. This is very complex, right? But again, once you get an understanding of where I should see expansion, where I should see compression. So my expansions are typically associated with finding that external rotation space. My internal rotations are more compressive. They're gonna give me a different representation of turning inward versus turning outward under certain circumstances. And so once I see those things, it's like I can watch somebody do a split squat across the gym and I can say, uh-oh, I got a little bit of a movement limitation over there, and I can identify what it most likely is. And then I can say, I need to change your movement strategy. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, something like, again, split squat always pops into my head. It's like, well, when will I use an offset loaded split squat where I put weight in one hand and not in the other? And then where am I going to position that weight? So if I have somebody that I see across the gym and they're doing a split squat and I see that knee deviate laterally as they descend into the split squat, well, there's my signal that person doesn't have internal rotation available to them at that point, and I want them to have it. Now I can say, okay, that's going to be your lead leg on a split squat, but I'm going to put a weight in the opposite hand, so a contralaterally loaded split squat, and it's going to help you turn into that hip. So now you're going to but a greater likelihood of being able to access that internal rotation. So ultimately, ultimately, that's what I want you to think about as you're learning and understanding these tests. It's like, yeah, it's really cool to throw somebody on the table and show the movement limitation, do something, and then make that movement limitation disappear, so to speak, right? But ultimately, what I want you to be able to do is go into the gym, just have people move, perform their exercise activities, and then be able to coach and cue them with that understanding.
I mean, makes perfect sense. And I have, since the beginning of the year, I've gravitated away from doing the tests frequently. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no perfect process, right? But
right.
I think it's really useful. It seems to me that it's very useful when you start working with somebody, or just every once in a while, especially if they're somebody in pain, to do the full battery of tests, as long as they appear to be on board
right.
with that direction. But I have noticed that like the more you do them with a specific person, the more you start to see what's going on, and it just relates across context. So that's good to have that confirmation.
Yeah. Like I said, I think it's fair that again, if this is within your scope and this is within your capabilities, then I think it's okay. But ultimately, like I said, and I think in your situation, you know, where you are in your career, it's probably useful for you to have this understanding of them. I don't know to what extent you would need to use them, but again, if it provides you confirmations, if it provides you some element of guidance, if your clients are okay with it, then I think that it becomes useful. But ultimately, it would be really cool when you get to the point where you just look across the gym and you go, uh-oh, I know what's going on. Here's what we're going to do. And then you intervene and then you see it clean up. Those are the really cool moments.
Right, right. And right? Those happen very sporadically for me, but.
Well, I mean, but they increase in number over time. Okay. So this is an experience thing, which you will acquire over time, just like everybody else does. The one thing you have to remember that it is an investment of time, right? It's not about following a cookbook and saying, oh, this does this and that does that. Mm-hmm. It's about understanding that we're playing in a very gray, complex area with a very complex system that doesn't behave the same way twice.
Right.
And that's why this is hard.
Okay. But it's a puzzle game.
It is. Does that help you, young man?
Yes, it's very helpful. Thank you.
Let's do a case study on a client that's having difficulty managing a late propulsive bias. Good morning. Happy Wednesday. I have NeuroCoffee in hand and it is perfect. All right. It is Wednesday. That means that tomorrow is Thursday, and I will see you at 6 a.m. on the Coffee and Coaches Conference call, as usual. These calls have been great. Great group of people. We have our regular people, and we get new people every week, so this is kind of exciting. They're great calls. I'm enjoying them. We go as long as we possibly can each call. So again, if you haven't joined in on those, please do try to make it, because they've been very, very productive and very helpful for a lot of people. Okay, digging into today's Q&A. This is a call I did with Robert, and Robert has a client case that we went through where we sort of strategized how to deal with a situation where we have a client that's biased towards late propulsion. They're having some issues associated with that. How do we bring them out of that? So we talked programming and strategy. We talked about management of activities, which is always a tough call. It's like, what do I take away? What do I still allow your clients to do? So we talked a little bit about that. And we even got into some foot management stuff associated with bunions at the end of the call. I've had a couple calls on bunions. So I'm going to try to put together one of these Q&As that's specifically about that. So that should be upcoming. I can't tell you exactly when, because it's going to require a little bit of editing on my part, and I am not technically skilled, even though it seems like I do such a fabulous job on these calls. Anyway, enjoy this call. Post your questions. Go to askbillhartman@gmail.com if you have any questions or you would like to participate in a 15-minute consultation. So again, askbillhartman@gmail.com, and I will see you guys tomorrow morning, 6 a.m., Coffee and Coaches Conference call. Have a great day.
Recording. Robert, what is your question?
So I've got a client that presents quite similarly to a photo that you put up in the, one of the IFAST University calls.
Okay.
It was a photo from Ireland. I don't know if you remember it. And it was a guy that had quite a lot of concentric orientation in his left hamstring and quite a late propulsive left foot.
Gotcha.
I've got a client that's kind of similar presentation, but and I'm really, the goal is trying to reduce the kind of stiffness and tightness in the left hamstring. And they're really sort of struggling to get around that and move on from that sort of problem at the moment. So I wonder if there's anything that you could help with that.
Okay, so let's talk about where his representation is now.
Yeah.
And from a strategy standpoint, I think there's a couple of things that we could probably do based on that. Okay. So you said it was left side?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So if I am in a late propulsive strategy on this side of the pelvis, what that means is that I'm going to be turning the sacrum away, right? So it's going to try to turn the sacrum to the right. So I'm going to push from behind here and it's going to turn the sacrum this way, right? Yeah. So what would be happening is that the center of gravity is traveling forward over the foot, right? Now, chances are when he's standing still, his heel's still on the ground, correct?
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Okay, but he's oriented as if he's trying to lift his heel from the ground.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I have here is a situation where I have a lot of concentric orientation here. I'll be concentrically oriented all the way down the extremity because I'm trying to propel myself forward. I'm trying to get my center of gravity forward and my heel up. So what I have is a constant state of load on that extremity. Because the load is instantaneous, the connective tissues of the foot, the lower leg, and the pelvis are all going to be in an overcoming state. So that's a very stiff representation of connective tissues. Now, it would be really nice if I could just reel that in, but I don't think that that's the easiest way to do that with this type of a person. So what we can do is we can take him to a place where we still have concentric orientation of the same musculature, but we have a different load on the connective tissue. So we can actually reduce the rate of loading on the connective tissues by moving him all the way back to an early propulsive strategy. So when we talk about this kind of a thing, we're talking about the heels elevated element, because what that does is it takes a foot, I'm gonna use a foot here real quick.
Yep.
It takes a foot and it moves it into this early propulsive representation. So the difference between the late and the early, it looks very much the same. So if I tip up the late here and I tip up the early, it looks very similar. But the difference is that I'm getting the elongation of connective tissues. So this is anything that is not contractile tissue, including the skeleton. So I get this resilience returning to the connective tissues where they can expand and actually start to store energy. Because right now, all you have is a perpetual state of load and we have to reduce that, okay? So again, we start to move him back. So, and again, using just a simple representation of that, we would use like the heels elevated squat concept. We would use, if we're doing like a split squat, you've got a front foot elevated split squat, but I would do a heels elevated split squat under those circumstances, because if I can bias the foot towards early, I'm going to bias the entire system towards that delay strategy on the affected side. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now, so let's just talk programming here.
Okay. Yeah.
So under most circumstances, I gotta create the delay. I gotta slow the left side down. So under those circumstances, I'm gonna want to shift my center of gravity backwards towards that left heel. So Think about all the other activities that you could probably do in the gym that would do this. Now, I want to reduce the loading strategy on that left side as well. So this is where anything where I'm pulling a cable downward is going to actually unweight me. So think about if I was in a staggered stance, so right foot forward, left foot back, and I was doing a cable chop towards that left side, well, that shifts me backwards. But because I'm pulling a weight down, it actually, the weight is pulling me off the ground in that direction. Yep. So it actually unweights me and makes it a lot easier to reduce the connective tissue load. And now I can actually recapture that yielding action a whole lot easier. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, it does.
Yeah. So again, from a strategy standpoint, I think there's a lot of things that you can do here. He can still train, but you've got to start to think about, okay, what is the rate that I'm loading this in? If he is pushed towards any element of this overcoming action of the connective tissues, you're gonna be fighting a battle that you can't win. You've got to start to move him back. You started creating delay strategies.
That takes kind of at the moment things like running and that kind of stuff out of the equation a little bit, right?
Because I'm afraid so. Yeah. I'm afraid so. But again, it's not that he can't train. It's just that he may not be able to do some of the things that he enjoys more, which is an unfortunate circumstance. Now, having said that, the way that I tend to address these things, unless it's overt interference. So if you got like a marathoner that does like really heavy mileage, right? I tend to not take things away from people unless it's obvious. And like I said, it's got to be this overt interference. So it's like, you know, like somebody that's got upper back compression and they want to do back squats. It's like, okay, we got to take that one kind of off the table because that's pure interference, right? But it's like I said, you know, if he wants to do like a different type of running under certain circumstances. So, you know, when I have a distance runner that's breaking back into a running progression, we'll have them do tempo runs on grass or something along those lines that changes the surface and then changes the pace. So they load their tissues a little bit differently. Right. So that might be a useful strategy for you. Maybe the conditioning becomes, you know, some element of something that would put us in sort of an early propulsive foot position. So like a backwards sled drag or something like that, that's an early propulsive strategy. But again, it's kind of conditioning oriented, not running, of course, but you know, like I said, you might have to limit those things.
Okay, cool. And then like pre sort of training, if there was going to be any running going on, is it sort of a good idea to try and use some of those types of activities prior to running to get a bit more of a,
Absolutely. Yeah. So think about it. It's like, okay, if I can create any element of this yielding action, then that's where I'm going to sort of initiate the programming. So they at least start in a good state.
Yeah.
And again, maybe you capture enough of it that, okay, all we have to do is sort of just back you off and then ramp you back up, utilizing these new activities to actually maintain this connective tissue behavior that we need.
Okay, great stuff. Yeah, and I suppose there's a little bit of a follow on from that. So kind of one of those clients that actually, when he's training, the movements, they look pretty good, right? So a slightly different point, but there are clients out there that sort of hide compensations quite well, if you like, or better than others anyway. Is that a fair thing to say? I was just wondering if that's the case, certainly in a scenario where we might be doing more digital type sessions and that kind of stuff. If that's the case, then is there any strategies that you might use to, because you can't necessarily do sort of checks and balances with those kind of clients before and after, or you can, but yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about that a little bit. All right.
Yeah.
All right. So we understand that as people move through space, that they're going to go through expansion, compression, and expansion strategies, right? So what we want to do is we want to have a representation of what that actually looks like. And so because we're short on time, I'm just going to direct you to a few things on the YouTube channel. So go through some of the breakdowns. So I did a pretty extensive half kneeling video, I recall. We've done a bunch of split stance activities. So from those, what you should be able to capture is that there's a certain place where I'm going to be biased towards expansion and external rotation. There's a certain place where I'm going to be biased towards internal rotation and compressive strategies. And they do have a representation. There's a visual representation of those. And so you start to take that concept and apply it to your coach's eye. And then you can start to say, oh, okay. So when I see somebody go into a split squat and I see that one hip higher than the other, I know that they're not acquiring internal rotation. So what I need to do then is within my program, I need to make sure that I'm selecting an activity that captures internal rotation in that position. So now you make modifications to ipsilateral versus contralateral loading, elevation of the foot, elevation of the rear foot, right? Do I need to move you off the imaginary sagittal plane and start to move you from side to side more, right? So there's a difference between doing a backward sled drag and doing a crossover sled drag, right? So under those circumstances, those are for different pelvic orientations. So I have to take that into consideration as well. So again, it's like, you know, if you understand where these external rotations and internal rotations are supposed to show up, I think there's a lot of things that you can do. It takes practice. You're going to make mistakes. Yeah. I make mistakes too.
Yeah.
It's okay. Don't hurt people. Don't hurt people. Always do safe experiments, right? But that's how you're going to figure this out. It's like, okay, there's a representation that I think is going on. I'm going to apply an intervention, and then we're going to see what happens. So if you do something correctly, in many cases, if they've got the adaptability available, they should change very, very quickly that you can actually see the difference in the before and the after. So you always want to have something as your comparator. So when we do these complex movements, they're very, very good because you can see when it gets better, right?
Yeah.
You just got to have a representation of what you're looking at, what it means to you, and then apply an intervention and see what happens. That is an appropriate trial and error, and safe experimentation is very scientific. You're allowed to do that.
Yeah, that's the job most of the time.
Well, it is, but underappreciated. Everybody thinks that there is a way, and there are many ways, right? We just need to understand what our intentions are, and then have a, like I said, a key performance indicator to let you know when you're making the right selection.
Yeah. Great stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. How are we good for time, or will we go?
Oh, let me see. Yeah. 2.5 minutes. You got something quick?
2.5 minutes. Back to that sort of first client, he presents with a little bit of the sort of the bunions on the foot as well that are kind of pointing him in the direction he wants to go, kind of thing.
Understood. Yeah. Yes.
I was wondering if you worked hard enough around that, would you expect that to change at all, or is that kind of like cemented in now?
So the answer to that question is it depends. So those things can progress to the point where they're not very changeable, other than with a surgical intervention within a certain range. Again, it depends on how much change there's been, but you can make changes, right? Because again, some of these orientations are just bony, and bones do move, bones change shape. So, you know, I'll have certain types of feet that will come in and people say, well, I've had this foot for a long time, but they've got enough adaptability. You've got to provide the right influence. So what you're looking at, just so you have an understanding of what you're looking at, that bunion evolution is internal rotation of that first ray of the foot, and it creates a twist right at the MTP joint. Okay. Oftentimes you'll see the same twist at the knee, or you'll see the same twist at the pelvis. You won't make a change if you only concentrate on one part of the body.
Yeah.
Okay. You've got to consider all of those top down influences as well. So make sure that you're capturing your foot cues. If you have a situation that if the arch is low, you're going to have to do something that might provide an arch. And so maybe that's a selecting a type of shoe. Maybe it's an orthotic situation, or if you have an athletic trainer handy, they can do some tapings to test run it for you, which is always a great way to find out if you need to make a foot change there. right? So again, it's going to depend on the actual representation that you're looking at. But in most cases, you're looking at somebody that's trying to drive internal rotation very aggressively, which means that they're missing it somewhere else. So now you've got a situation where, okay, I need to capture my external rotation so I can have a bigger space to acquire my internal rotation and then take it away so the foot doesn't have to be the compensation strategy, right? But I think that we go back to the beginning of this conversation. It's like, okay, where am I going to capture that first? I think you take these people back to this early propulsive strategy. And again, maybe make a foot, a shoe modification or an orthotic situation along with that. And I think that's where you're going to start.
Great stuff. Appreciate it. Thanks very much, Bill.
Well, you're very welcome. I appreciate you. Thanks for participating. I appreciate it.
Cool, hopefully. The university call. I'll catch you on the next IFAST University call.
Oh, okay, excellent. We'll see you there.
Good, Bill.
Happy Thursday. I have Neural Coffee in hand, and it is perfect.
Hey, Bill, talking about the vastus lateralis, I heard you say in one video that it twists the femur into internal rotation. If it's on the lateral aspect of the femur, how can it do that?
So again, you got to look at where it attaches. You've got to look at the orientation of the muscle fibers themselves. And then we have to also look at it in context. Okay. So if I fix the distal attachment, so VL comes down, it contributes to the quadriceps tendon, it attaches to the patella attaches to the tibial tuberosity, right? So if I fix the tibial tuberosity, right? So basically, it's basically putting your foot on the ground kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Put my foot on the ground and I contract VL. Because of its orientation, because of its position, it's going to create an internal rotation force on the femur, but it doesn't cross the hip. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's going to twist the femur inwards first. Then it's going to hit eventually you run out of like bony capability, right? Like the bone can only twist so far. So the bone twists inward and then it's going to pull the hip with it eventually, right?
Got it.
Unless you have another force that's acting on the other end, which is going to hold it into external rotation, which is really common. Okay. But that's basically what you're going to end up with. You do have a force that turns it into internal rotation. You also have that downward force into the ground that's going to contribute to that whole mechanism too. But as if we're just looking at VL and its behavior, it's going to provide you that type of a turn. Okay.
Now that we're talking about some muscles too, with shoulder impingement, compression below the level of the scapula, you got the biggest muscle there, the lat. The lat attaches to that, to the humerus and does extension and internal rotation. Is that why you said that when you have compression, or one of the reasons why you have, if you have compression there, it's going to steal early external rotation from the scapula because it's pulling it into that rounded shoulders, internal rotated position? Is that why? Because that's one.
But what if I fix the humerus? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So you're using that dead guy representation of lats.
Yeah.
So, are you sitting at a desk?
Yes.
Okay. Would you stand up, please?
Yes.
And put your hands on the desk. Mm-hmm. So your arms are straight and you're kind of leaning on your hands. Okay.
Yep.
Got it. Okay.
Yes.
You got weight on your hands?
Yes.
Arms are straight.
Yes.
Awesome. Pick up your right hand, push through your left hand and turn your body to the right, but don't move your arm. So you're going to turn, you're making a turn to the right away from your left arm. Okay. Got it.
Got it.
Okay. So that's latissimus dorsi turning you to the right.
That's my left latissimus dorsi because I'm putting the weight.
That is correct, sir. Your left latissimus dorsi just turned you to the right. Okay. And it just put you, it just puts you in a position where external rotation exists. So that compression on the back of your thorax moved external rotation from straight ahead over to the to what is now your left. So there is no space in front of you where you can access external rotation because of the compression on the back of the rib cage. Do you understand? Do you see it?
So it's turning me into external rotation.
It's orienting you. It's orienting you into external rotation. That is correct. But external rotation, if you had full excursion and you were able to expand that posterior rib cage, external rotation would still be straight in front of you as you initiate arm elevation away from your body. But because of the compressive strategy on the back side, it moves it over that way. Because it's changing your physical shape and therefore the space around you to access that motion moves from here to over there.
That compression. Okay. It moves it from more of that straight ahead plane, that sagittal
plane. Yes, sir. So what happens, so if I am compressed in that area and I don't have the external rotation space to create a space for movement, I immediately go towards my internal rotation behaviors, and then I run out of internal rotation at 90 degrees, and that's why people walk in and they go, my Hawkins Kennedy is positive. And they say, I got impingement. And everybody goes, oh, you have a rotator cuff problem. Okay, you have a rotator cuff result, okay, potentially. But it is a compressive strategy that changes your physical shape, which means that the space around you changes as to where you can access motion or how you access motion. It doesn't mean you can't put your arm in that space. It just means that the way you're going to do it is not going to be with what we would consider normal relative motion, which provides us ease of motion, right? You're gonna have a limitation based on the physical shape of your body, okay? Now, the way that you described it, with the lattice, the internal rotator extender, is that what you said?
Yeah, extender.
That does work to a degree. So it's not a useless model. It's just probably not close enough to reality. It runs out of usefulness too soon, if you will.
Got it.
As far as providing a solution. Because the minute you expand that space back there that you just compressed with your latissimus dorsi, your motion comes back and you eliminate what would be diagnosed as an impingement.
Question about the right oblique orientation and ER measures. So correct me if I'm wrong here, but when we get the right oblique, the left lower posterior starts to approximate sacrum and ilium and it drives it up and over.
So you got to be careful. Yeah. But generally speaking, you're on the right track, but it's not going to be posterior lower. Okay.
It's going to be upper.
It's higher. Okay. So once again, it's like we're kind of talking about the same thing again this morning, right? It's like, okay, we call it a muscle and then it gets all distracted and we've got parts of muscles that are actually behaving separately from other parts of muscles. Okay. So I'm gonna give you a name of a muscle by tradition that will guide you in this, okay?
Okay.
If you looked at piriformis.
Okay.
And if you concentrically orient a piriformis, that will guide you to an understanding of the creation of the right oblique axis.
Okay.
Do you want me to show you real quick?
Yeah.
So if we look at, if anatomically speaking, if we look at piriformis being like right, kind of like right there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm going to do it on this side because I'm a better righty than a lefty here. All right. So piriformis is right there. It's actually on the front side here. Okay.
Yeah.
So if piriformis runs roughly, like if you were trying to find piriformis on a human being, you would say, where's the greater trochanter and then where's the PSIS? And you draw the line in between them, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So if I contract piriformis, what's going to happen?
You're going to come closer together.
And you're gonna Yeah. So I have this diagonal line that's going to try to be a straight line.
Yeah.
Okay. Think about that. Because everybody's going to go, oh, you externally rotate. Don't think that way. approximate the two ends to make it the shortest possible distance. Okay. So what happens under those circumstances is that it's going to pick this up. So it's on this angle like this. Yeah. If I contract piriformis, it's going to shorten in this direction, right? But it's going to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what it looks like is that.
Gotcha.
You see it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what pushes you on that. So if you look at it like this, and you appreciate the fact that piriformis is not a flat muscle, it is in this diagonal helical orientation, right? So if I shorten it, it's going to go like that. It's going to pull this closer to this, and it's going to do that. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
You see it?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's not posterior lower. Posterior lower compression pushes me straight forward.
Okay.
Thank you. You see the difference?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, and it's like, and then you have the question mark. Say, well, why would I choose to do one over the other? Well, okay. How tall is your innominate bone? How wide is your pelvis? Right? What is your helical orientation? How wide is your ISA? It's like all of those things come into play from a mechanical standpoint as to what is the best strategy under the circumstances for you to apply to manage gravity. And so there's subtle differences in how you would do that, right? It's just like somebody that's 7 feet tall, you know, walking against a really strong wind, and somebody that's 5'2" walking against the same wind, different strategies.
Right. And so when you would go to your testing under those circumstances, would you expect the hip flexion to be more limited than the external rotation at 90 degrees?
Which side are we talking about, boss?
Left side.
I can't hear you.
Left side.
Left side. Left side would initially have more ER.
Initially.
Because so again, there's not one oblique, there's not one axis that this would tilt on, and how far forward is the center of gravity?
Right.
The farther forward the center of gravity, the more I start to get that little trickle down effect on the posterior aspect of the hip, where I start picking up more concentric orientation. You understand?
And you mean, so you would eventually maybe get the posterior lower? If you're so far.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you will. But I have to push you farther forward.
Got it.
You see it? So I'm tipped up on this oblique, and it's like, oh, hey, you know what? You don't lose internal rotation right away either.
Right. Yeah.
You don't. But if I keep pushing you forward, it starts to disappear very quickly.
Right. Okay. This is making sense. Cause you've talked about it in several videos, and I think about different gradations of it based on certain presentations. I'm like, oh, is that the oblique axis? Is that the one? And I'm trying to find the one.
Did you say gradation?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the perfect word. It's the perfect word, because that's why there's not one singular representation, because everything is a gradient. Right? Everything's happening at the same time. So when I go on this oblique tilt, I may actually pick up internal rotation on the side where we talk about losing internal rotation.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And then as I keep shifting it forward, because I gotta move my center of gravity so I don't fall backwards and I don't fall forwards, right? So I have to shift my center of gravity. So I'm gonna move it forward and forward and forward. But the shape of the pelvis has to change as I do that. So I'm gonna start to pick up more of that posterior lower activity. You see it?
I got it. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is why if you're doing traditional measures, initially you get this crazy external rotation representations where you get like 70 degrees of hip abduction, which doesn't even exist, right? But it measures that way. And then you get the next person that comes in, you go, oh, they're on an oblique axis. I should expect to see all this crazy hip abduction, and you get 15. And then you go, how is that even possible? They're on an oblique. I know they're on an oblique. And it's right. Oh, they got shoved forward so far that the muscle orientations changed again.
Right. And they lost the posterior lower, but you might test them on the right side on hip abduction, and they've started to pick up an expansive strategy in posterior lower. because of the degree of the turn, and they'll have more on the right than the left.
I don't think they'll pick up an expansive strategy. I think what you'll see is that it just didn't compress as much because you're not good, like, unless you've got somebody that's walking around with their butt cheek sticking way back in relative to the other one, you know. Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you see that kind of representation, they got a whole lot of stuff going on there. But that's what it would have to look like for you to gain an expansive strategy, right?
Yeah, right. So it'd be just relative too. So you might see like a somewhat limited on the right, but more limited on the left if you're that pushed. Okay, got it.
Yes. And under those circumstances, you would see the traditional right shift in a squat.
Got it. Okay, perfect.
You see it? Because it's more expanded on the posterior right. And so if I squat down, I'm going to move towards expansion. That's why you get a right shift, is because there's more expansion in that direction.
And the reason you would initially have the ER on the left is because you just changed where that ER space is relative to the orientation of the pelvis?
Yeah. So you just tipped it forward, right? And turned it.
So now straight ahead is really out to the side.
so now we're back to Christian. We're back to putting your hands on the desk. Was it Christian?
Yeah.
We put his hands on the desk and we turned him. It's the same thing, right?
Yeah, got it.
It's literally the same thing. Like what we just did, that test with hands on the table, turn away from the hand, is what you just asked me about.
Gotcha.
Except you did it with your foot on the ground. Get it?
Got it.
All right.
Okay.
Let me give you a quick representation. Ready?
Sure.
Ever see a turtle?
I definitely did.
Okay. Turtles cannot applaud.
Absolutely right.
Why can't they applaud?
Because they're...
They go to the concert.
I mean...
Songs. They love the band, but they just kind of sit there and they go, Right? They can't
add up, yeah, at all. They
Yeah. So they're out here. They're out here because they're flat on the front, big round back, plenty of ER.
ER. Mm-hmm.
No IR.
So you would say the turtle IR window is smaller. I mean, they have to IR to go forward, right? They have to push into the ground and go forward.
Yes, but that's why they walk with their feet out really, really wide, right? Mm-hmm. There, you'll never see a turtle tightrope walker.
That would be dope.
I would love to see that, by the way.
So let's review the origin of a wide ISA archetype. Good morning. Happy Friday. I have NeuroComfie in hand, and it is perfect. All right. Man, what a busy week, but a good one. Wrapping up the week with a lot of stuff today. Mike Roberts and I are shooting a bunch of video for iFastU. So if you're not an iFastU member, I suggest you join up so you can actually join in the fun. We've got some great practitioners on there, great coaches, really evolving quickly. So the questions are getting really, really deep and very, very useful. So again, please consider that. For today's Q&A, I talked to Larry down in Texas yesterday. Really good conversation. I let him go a little bit long. He was the last call of the day. And so we had some fun there. You'll see it on the call. We were playing back and forth a little bit. But what we did talk about that I think is really important is the foundational representation of the archetypes. We used specifically a wide ISA archetype that we built off of. And then we actually talked about why we have to use some form of representative model, because we're managing this incredible complexity. We don't understand it, and so we have to find a way to simplify that. So we talked about that as well. So again, very useful for your understanding. So I think you'll enjoy today's Q&A, the podcast of the weekend review will be up on Sunday morning as usual, and then I will see you all next week. So if you got questions, send them to askbillhartman@gmail.com, askbillhartman@gmail.com. And I'll see you guys next week.
I thought it might help me understand your model because he clearly is.
Just ask me.
I would rather, but I mean, you know, your heart, you know, I don't know. You don't have a book out there.
Huh?
I don't know if you have a book out there. I'd, I mean, I'm always watching. I watch all your videos over and over again.
I appreciate
that. I mean, it's amazing the information and the way you break things down. But in any event, I now I've kind of lost my train of thought. But when you talk about a bias, or when we say, when you say that the lower rib cage, you have a narrow or wide lower rib cage, which biases you towards either inhalation or exhalation, yes, right? Yes. And a lot of times people will say, or hear you say, we'll say the wide is biased towards expansion, right? Or inhalation. And then, but like in Bill's book, he says, you know, he says that it is an expansion, but he calls it a compensation, and that the bias is towards exhalation. Yes. So I think sometimes those terms are used interchangeably, not by you guys, but other people. And then it gets
kind of, because they don't understand it. They don't understand it.
Exactly. So I'm going to the source.
Okay. So what's your question? So this is going to be a really good question. Go ahead and ask it.
So the question is, if you're wide or narrow, whichever, let's go with wide, because that's what I am.
Yeah.
Then that means that is my bias towards inhalation expansion, and therefore my compensation is compression exhalation, or is it something else?
All right. So when you're a wide infrasternal angle individual that lacks full breathing excursion. So we have to be very, very specific here as to what we are talking about.
Okay.
Because everybody has a physical structure.
Correct.
We're talking about the people that lose extremity movement.
Right.
Because of the compensations that they're using. So we have to be very specific about this.
Okay.
All right. So when I say wide ISAs or narrow ISAs and the things that I talk about, I'm talking very specifically about the people that have lost ranges of motion. Okay.
Okay.
Which means that they are using a compensatory strategy to breathe, which requires them to utilize superficial musculature that prevents. So if I'm squeezing, or if I'm concentrically orienting muscle, so I'm trying to shorten muscle to create a breathing strategy, it's going to restrict motion in that joint that it affects. Okay.
Right.
Okay. All right. So for a wide ISA individual, my axial skeleton, okay, the axial skeleton, not the appendicular, but the axial skeleton,
right,
is biased towards exhalation by structure. They're better exhalers, they're better force producers, right? They're better squeezers in general by the axial skeleton.
Okay.
All right. If my bias is to be a better exhaler, I have to figure out a way to compensate and breathe in.
Correct.
Okay. So for someone that is a wide ISA bias, the best strategy for me is to try, and again, you have to use your diaphragm to breathe. So I'm going to push my diaphragm down, which is inhalation, which holds the ISA open wide. Yep. And that's why I don't talk about numbers with an ISA. I talk about behavior of an ISA. So if my ISA is biased in a compensatory strategy to breathe in against the exhalation of my axial skeleton, it's going to hold the ISA open. And so it doesn't close when I exhale.
Okay.
So a wide ISA representation. So the archetype of the wide ISA is somebody that has an axial skeleton that is a better exhaler than an inhaler. And then they cheat to inhale. And so it holds the ISA open wide, which is an inhalation strategy, but they're bias, the axial skeletal bias, their structural bias is exhalation.
And thus the wide ribs, because your strategy is to try to inhale. And that's right. The only place you can
do
it.
And that's why it doesn't, but see, that's why it doesn't move, right? That's why it doesn't close. Because I don't care what the measurement is. I don't care what the angle is. People that are putting goniometers on thoraces are just wasting time and effort.
because it's not the number that matters. It's the behavior that matters, because it's the behavior that tells me what your bias will be.
Okay.
Does that help you?
That's just really helpful. And I'm assuming that would I be able to find this video to be able to go back over
which
some
video, of the which video you're talking about, boss?
The one we're doing right now.
I'm going to post it.
Okay, so I'll be able
you're
to.
You're famous now.
Yeah.
You're going to be the go-to guy down in Texas. Did that help you though? As far
yeah,
as
it did. Yeah, absolutely. It's something I'll need to go back and you know listen to again and think about again. But yeah, it because I'm obviously I had a little backwards there. So but it does. And then I being able to go back and look at this video and which I really will hate to do because I hate looking at myself on the screen.
But the world's gonna love looking at you, boss.
Yeah, they really won't. But I appreciate it. And where else can I mean, other than your videos, I mean, how else can I get, learn more about your model? Because what I love about it, and you just talked to a guy the other day, you were telling him that eventually you want to get to the point, especially people like me who, you know, train people all the time, where you don't have to do the table measurements, that you can right. just look at somebody right. and say, based on where they're not able to act, what motion they're not able to access.
Yes,
that's
sir.
Where I want to be. Because okay. in my business, people don't want to sit on the table. They do with you, but they don't want with me.
Yeah, I understand. That's why this becomes so important, is because it does provide you a representation of what's going on, or at least a measure of understanding, so you can be more accurate with your interventions,
right?
Rather than random. Now, there's always elements of test, retest, and safe to fail experiments and things like that, because you're dealing with a crazy amount of complexity. What we're doing is we're using a model to try to simplify this, so we can provide better recommendations. There's always an element of experimentation, but like I said, the understanding of this model that I use, all right, helps me cut to the chase much quicker. I'm much more accurate with all of the interventions that you're going to use, regardless right. of whether we're designing an exercise program or a rehab program or whatever. Again, it all depends on which environment that I'm in, but that's the goal, is to one, simplify this complexity, because it is beyond our understanding. We really don't. I mean, there are so many influences that we don't even understand yet. So we have to use heuristics, rules of thumb, and modeling to make better decisions. So that is the goal. As far as where you can get access. So are you on IFAST University?
I thought I was, but I'm not sure that I am, because I don't
want to check, because that's direct access. That's direct access to me and Mike Robertson.
Yeah.
So we talk about this all the time. So I'm on calls like twice a month with that. Plus we're shooting a bunch of video tomorrow that we're going to be posting. So you'll have access to all those. And then you're in a Facebook group with a whole bunch of other people that are on IFAST2, and you get to ask questions every day if you want.
That's great. And so by the way,
probably the best place for you, considering sure. what you do for a living.
Absolutely. Okay. And I want to tell you that I a really smart guy told me, or I read that he said, I didn't, you know, he didn't tell me specifically, that all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Yeah. That's George Box.
I know, but you're the one I got.
Well, I borrowed it from George Box. Trust me.
I know. And you referenced him. He's
much smarter than I ever will be.
And you referenced him. You definitely gave him the reference, yeah. but well, you're the one I heard.
Everybody about. References him now, right? It's a yeah. requirement. If you use the word model, you have to use the quote from George Box.
Yeah. And I put that up on my board because it was one of my daily yeah. sayings. And then somebody came along and put right between model, they put super.
Oh.
That right. changes everything.
It does change everything.
It really changes everything.
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
All right.
That's fantastic.
I appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. All right.
Take care of yourself. All right.
You too. Bye-bye.